From 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Bill. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Development. When you work in technology, that word means two important things. Development refers to the process of writing the software you need to keep things moving, like the code that manages a business or the infrastructure that keeps a nation rolling. But it also refers to the process of growing, learning, and adapting with the changing market, both as a business and as an individual. Excelling at either one of those is hard enough for most companies, but when you put both of them together, you can achieve some really significant results. That's what Michael Rappaport learned as he led his company through 15 years of growth, despite a recession, some geographic challenges, and pressure from competitors who wanted to steal the talent that he spent so much effort developing. It's the story of Chariot Solutions, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
Well, first, I want to welcome you to The Build. We're excited to talk to you because, the thing that leapt out to me in your bio is I think we're both folks that decided 2002 would be a great year to launch companies. Tell me a little bit about the origin of Chariot and why you decided to launch a company in 2002.
That's a great question. And obviously, you have an understanding of why that seems like an odd time to start a new business. Sure, I will try to condense this story. But prior to starting Chariot Solutions, I ran a software company. We had a software package. The company was called Skylight Systems, and we had an accounting and supply chain management suite of modules that was geared toward wholesale distributors in a variety of industries. I ran that business for 10 years for another company, a parent company called ATD America. In late 2001, ATD, the parent company, and for a variety of reasons, we decided to sell that business. I didn't choose the timing, but at that company, I had a staff of about 40 people, and I was what I consider a normal kind of company, as opposed to what I'm going to tell you about Chariot, which is not a normal kind of company. But I had superstars, you know, a handful of absolute superstars, and they got paid the most. And I had mid-level people, and I had lower-level people, and it was just normal. But when I went to do something new, the first thing I thought of is something had been proven to me. In the latter part of that endeavor, the Skylight endeavor, we decided to re-engineer our software from this older fourth generation language into Java. And in that process, we set up teams to do this, and something I've been aware of forever, and this is a technical thing, but it's not a matter of opinion, it's a fact in our industry, and it's something that I believe is somewhat unique to our industry, is first you have to understand this part. Most professional software developers are not cut out for this sport, this job. They're just not. And they're in it. And I know I went to school. I majored in management of computerized information systems. And I worked with people developing software, taking these classes. And the ones who weren't cut out for it, they may be great students. They could get A's. You know, they had to work so hard on their projects. And they had to struggle through their technology courses. And the people who got it, it was second nature. It was so easy. But anyway, they make it out into the field. And when they're in the field, it's kind of hard to justify mid-level people in software development. There's such a giant gap between them and the superstars. Problem is, there aren't enough superstars out there. And so at my small company, Skylight Systems, my old company, the person I brought on, who is actually Aaron Mulder, who's my CTO at Chariot, I brought him on at Skylight to lead this effort. And when I did so, he pitched me. We had three project teams. We set out to build application framework, reporting framework, and testing framework. And when we built those, then people could be very productive in migrating all of our software. But building the platform is hard. So they convinced me, they offered to do it with half the team size. They cut each of the three teams in half, but we're only going to use the best people. That was the offer. Since I am a techie, that was my background, and I understand the gap, and I'm open-minded, and I pride myself on that. You know, I looked at the plan and I said, well, on the testing framework, there were only two people on the team, you know, and they said, well, we'll do it with one. I try to say yes. I mean, my kids will tell you my middle name is yes. I don't always say yes, but I always try to. I want to. And so we tried it. And Joe, it was like, it was unbelievable. What happened when you put a small team of incredibly skilled people together, and it's not just their technical skills, it has a lot to do with personality and professionalism and communication, a lot of other things, not just technical. It was incredible what happened. So when the parent company went to sell Skylight, and I was looking at what's next, there's what's next for me, and there's what's next for this group of about, instead of the 40 people, there were a group of 8 to 10. That, man, these people should not be separated. What they can do, what they have to offer is incredible. And so one plan was for me to take them and to start a consulting company, like Chariot. Mm-hmm. I couldn't start a software company because I didn't have the financial resources at that time. And as you know, 2002 was not a good time to get money right after 9/11 and all of that. And so clearly the reason we did this in that time frame was because I had no choice. That was when the company was to be sold. And when I took these people and I talked to them about, I created a business plan with some help from my mentors. I was very, very lucky. When I did this, there was a gentleman named David Lipson. He has since passed away a few years ago. David, not the David Lipson from Philadelphia Magazine.
A different David Lipson, yeah.
He was an incredibly successful entrepreneur, and he had done it for so many years, and he helped hundreds and hundreds of people like he helped me. And he was tough, but when it needed tough. And he really helped them. We created a business plan. And then I took this business plan that was a business plan for a regular type of consulting company, kind of like David Lipson had back in his time. And I brought that in front of my 10 people that I was going to start with. And they all read through it and they liked a lot of things, but they thought we should be something else. They said, well, do we want to be as big as we can, as fast as we can? Is that part of this mission? Are we trying to be the biggest or the fastest growing? And I said, no, I don't think so. So they said, well, then let's shoot to be, if we're going to be the best at something, let's be the best at the highest quality. Let's be different. And the thing is, Joe, this is the point they made to me. It really stuck with me. It's not my ideas. We're not my ideas. They said, we manufacture software. We're manufacturers. And in software development, it's embarrassing, the track record for failure, you know, success and failure. It's incredible. What other kind of industry, even in the most optimistic estimates of 75% project success in software development? Can you imagine a manufacturer of some widgets that they fail, 25% are defective, they're out of business tomorrow. And so I understood that. I appreciated that. They said, we want to be held to other standards, 98, 99% like others. It's hard to be perfect, maybe impossible to be perfect. And so, and these people are so professional. I have such great respect for them. I thought about it. I really considered it. And we looked into it. And we said, well, it's really the similar argument they made to me at Skylight. Smaller teams, higher skilled people, except we're going to do the development for our customers instead of for ourselves, for other people. But we have to commit to only bringing on the best people, which means we're going to sacrifice growth. Okay, sounded good. And in the beginning, I brought that back to my mentors and they laughed at me a little bit because they said, well, how will you make money? I mean, it sounds great. Essentially, this is an oversimplification, but service business. In the service business, we try to get 90% utilization. If you assume 10% is paid time off, then you strive, you know, accountants, lawyers, people like us, IT software, IT services, you try to get 90% utilization or as close to it as you can get. Well, that doesn't work for the top tier people in my industry. They need to be, that will cause them to be stagnant in some areas. And, you know, they're, so anyway, there's a lot of reasons. We said, well, we as a team said, what if we strive for 80% utilization and we take an extra 10% and we devote it to pay professional development for our staff, for everyone here. And that's in the form of being trained, going to conferences, all kinds of things, hacking at open source projects. They spend their time how they want to, but it all furthers our business, helps our business, and mainly it really helps them be happy. It helps us create what we set out to create, which is the best place to work for these kind of people.
So the interesting transition there from a typical service business doing a 90-10 rule to an 80-10-10 is, in organizations that embrace professional development, often that takes the form of, we're going to send our folks to seminars, we're going to send them out to conferences. But the thing that I've observed about what you do with Chariot is that you actually cultivate people who are leading initiatives. A lot of Chariot folks are out there at the forefront of major technologies. They're running seminars, they are running conferences. So how do you actually cultivate people who want to lead within their focus, their attention?
Yep. So that's something I also, that I think that's something I really pride myself on, is my open-mindedness. And at Chariot, we're a very flat type of company. We have the, if you're here, it's the culture of peers, not someone works for somebody else. it really isn't like that. It's a culture of mutual respect and of believing in each other. And so here, when we started, so we're a consulting firm. That's on the surface. You see, we do, you know, almost all of our revenue, so much of our revenue comes from consulting, building software for other people. That said, many years ago, Ken Rimple just wanted to start, he was passionate about training and doing formal technical training. And he had a background of that. Now, he was patient and did some consulting while we made a plan and put a plan together and then ran that in front of my mentors and my devil's advocates and my board and all of our committees. And if it survives these people, it's a good idea. And so it had legs, and we executed on that plan. And we have for now, for the last 4 years, had a formal training practice where we train people in a lot of the subjects, the technologies that we work on for our customers out there and we're passionate about. And you mentioned a good point. I mean, our people are out there speaking, presenting. They're very passionate about certain things, mobile, you know, and mobile development, big data and those concepts. There are several different variety of things and technologies underneath them. We are geeks in what we do. It's really what we're excited about is what the new technologies can do for businesses. It's really all geared toward business. It's very important that we're focused. You know, how do you get the track record we have? Well, you have to deliver on time and within budget. That's a business. You don't have forever. We'd love to be perfectionists, you know, but, and so all of these things are factors in this hiring discipline and what we do. And Joe, back up one step about the beginning, get you to kind of feel something. So in the beginning, when we created this 80-10-10 model, my mentor said, how are you going to make a profit? You know, obviously we'd have to command a premium, just like my team at Skylight. I didn't have to pay double for the better people. I had to pay more, but they're half the team size. So it makes financial sense. It makes every kind of sense. But that's the same thing that we do here is we said, well, we'll have to command a premium in the industry, in the market, but we're not charging double. Well, that's great, but you have no reputation when you start. You have no brand. Plus, it's 2002. It's a terrible time. You know, there were so many things. So the magic part of this, I have a lot of faith in these people. You have to understand these 10 people I'd worked with for over 10 years on average with them. I had been in the organization for 17 years. I had run the business for 10. And I really believe in them. As I said, I always try to say yes. It was very risky. The approach required that whenever a single person went out and did a consulting gig, the customer was blown away. Blown away. And I got to tell you, and this is why I love these people so much. That's what I've been dealing with for 14 years, is letters from my customers and feedback from my customers. And I do reviews for our people. It's unbelievable. They pay a premium, and yet they can't help but tell us how great the people are and the difference that they're making. And even in 2009, 2010 timeframe, some of our customers, I mean, Comcast is my biggest customer by far. At that time, they were not. But at that time, we had a few people. They canceled. I heard they canceled their outsourced projects, their outsourced IT projects. Things, you know, hit the fan. And things got shelved. Well, I didn't hear that formally. When they contacted us formally, they actually asked us for another person or two instead of letting our people come back. So then I had to get involved. And I said, well, what's happening? Can you guys shed some light on this? We heard from reliable sources, you're killing your projects. And the guy said, well, it's true. We have to shelve most of our projects for this year, for temporarily. But there's some things have to get done. And he said, those things, we cannot afford to fail on those things. So I'm allowed to use Chariot. I have permission to exclusively use Chariot for that. I have a lot of pride in that, you know, with these people. And then another thing is our conference that you're probably familiar with from our site, maybe ETE, Philly Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise. I'm incredibly proud of that. We speak at it, but we want to hear people speak from all around the world that are the creators of the intellectual property. That's where we go in this stuff. We want to know who created Spark and who's working on Angular and who's working on these today, these popular things, and let's get involved with them. That's what we want. And so we have ETE originally it's been over 10 years now we've had ETE, and now it's many years. It sells out in the early bird, and we have the most incredible lineups, and I deserve zero credit other than approving a budget, you know, for that thing. The team does all the work and they're amazing. Going out there, and besides, I send over 40 people to it every year. We wouldn't miss it. It's over 2 days of action packed. It's exactly what we want. And it doesn't come out of their 10%. It's something we want. So their conferences are, that's outside of ETE. But people that want to present, it does a lot for our brand. I mean, our brand means so much to us. And so if we have today we have some heavyweights on Scala technology, let's say, for example, and we do. They're out there speaking in New York and speaking, you know, different areas. Even though we don't do that much business in those areas, it's important for our brand and it's important for the people who are working on the intellectual property to know they can rely on us to do that kind of work. Now, one thing I'll say is we're not willing to get in bed with anyone, any one vendor. It's just, I don't tell my team what to do. We're a team. You know, we talk about it, we discuss it. And these other companies, they would love it. If you get in bed with them, then you're trying to sell subscriptions for them. That's great. Well, we're not. But we have a philosophy. We say, well, wouldn't it be worth more to our customers if we say to Vanguard, you know, we recommend Scala, even though we're not embedded with them. We recommend it because it's the best thing for this project. That's what we believe. Isn't that more powerful than, well, sometimes these other companies don't care about that. They just want us to sell subscriptions. And it's just not what we're going to do.
Well, I think it gives you the ability to evolve your thinking over time, because if you observe another technology or another platform gaining steam, you could advise clients to start investigating that.
Exactly. Which you know happens. That's going to happen. You can guarantee it. So if you're out to make the most money, maybe you would make these other decisions. It's much easier for us because when we decide, we always weigh everything against. We have a very simple list of overarching goals and objectives as a company that we've had established over 10 years ago. There are only 7 items on the list, and I actually can't even recite from memory 4 through 7 because we all agreed that if we focus on the top 3, the rest will take care of themselves. The top 3 have nothing to do with money. And each of the top 3, so the number 1 is sustain our near perfect client satisfaction record. That is number 1 first and foremost. We make a decision sometimes with a customer. You know, you don't know who's at fault. Or maybe we know the customer's at fault. It doesn't matter. You know, we need to, it's all about customer satisfaction. They don't know they're at fault, you know, and so we just do what it takes. It's all about customer satisfaction. Secondarily, and this is our chief marketing officer's top priority, we do our brand, like I said, is very important to us. We invest in building our brand. And so that's how we get the rates we get. That's how people know we're still a steal at these rates. Her top priority is to enhance our brand as a best of breed provider of the services we provide. And then the third, and this is my top priority, is to enhance the loyalty, value, and happiness of our team. And it's by far the best job I ever had. The people, you can tell maybe from this interview how much respect I have for these people. And so it's the most incredibly natural thing to want to treat them really, really well. And it's all about creating that and having them be happy. Sometimes to be happy, they want to start something new. They want to be an entrepreneur. I have a gentleman right now, he was a consultant, and he's interested in expansion to New York City for charity. It's not something that was on my list necessarily, but again, we ran it by the team, and we don't have a strong reason to say no. We can say yes. Let's approve an evaluation. And that's where we are right now. So if that evaluation comes back with a positive, next thing you know, we may have an office in New York, you know, but the real question, can we hire there and can we sell there?
Well, yeah, and that sounds to me like an organic outcropping of something that a team of developers would do. The thing I'm accustomed to seeing in development is, well, let's test it. Yes. So you want to go to New York? Well, let's test it out. Let's see if we can get a foothold there. At worst, you have one person in a satellite office or one person kind of working remotely. At best, you create a new field office.
Exactly.
To grow its own legs.
Yes, exactly right.
Well, I think that one of the other things that I observe is we were talking about this, the growth and development of this team back in 2002, 2003, and you were going through processes that we didn't have words for them then, but they're lean methodologies and agile methodologies. We just didn't know what to call it back then. But
exactly right. I say the same things you're saying. I'm telling you, I do.
So whoever came up with those terms, it made it so much easier for us to explain how small organizations can have big impacts.
Yes.
But I want to go back to the concept when you're recruiting, when you're identifying talent, this concept that talent leaps up at an order of magnitude. And so compared to the kind of organizational chart or the career journey that somebody might have in a large organization, there's more of this snapping tipping point where somebody goes from, I guess the current buzz phrase is from typical engineer to that 10X engineer, that 10X developer. So in your mind, when you're looking to recruit folks, what are the competencies that you look for that would determine that someone has what it takes to be in that top 20% of talent that you look for?
Okay, so this is a little, I'm above this or outside this area a bit, meaning that I'm not doing the actual, by the time they interview with me, they're as good as hired at that point. But our process is everything to us. And so, and I believe in it, and it's been proven to work extremely well over time. So it starts with the obvious thing, the tech part. Now, I'm going to tell you that in 14 years ago, we had to interview 35 people for every one that we hire. 14 years later, we have to interview 32 people for every one we hire. Now, that sounds terrible to me. Okay, but it's not as bad as it sounds. For one thing, the interviews aren't as exhaustive. We are actually able to weed people out at an earlier stage in the process. We've gotten a lot better at that. And when you realize the people we're looking for, so what happens is the phone screen weeds out a lot. But after a phone screen, there's an exhaustive. The real magic starts with a real interview, which is multiple people on our side interviewing a candidate. There's a code test, a design exercise. There's so many things that are proven to show in an hour or two how well this person masters coding, the art of coding and development, and understands the concepts of design, software design. That's the start, because our people are designing in the beginning, basically the software you build, even if it looks like it does what they were supposed to do on the spec, it won't scale or perform or be as stable as it should be if it's not architected properly. And that's what we're all about, that architecture is the harder part. To code it is very important, but it's that well-rounded person, that software architect we want. And once they pass that, and I'll tell you, 1 out of 10 pass that. We only hire 1 out of 32. The rest of it's the magic. And I will tell you the most important part, the absolute, I know this because I read all the write-up. Most important question is, would you like to work with this person? And I know that's very subjective, but the people who are doing the interviews, they understand it. They are team humble players. They're technical people and consultants, but they're business people too. They care about this company. I get ideas from all over the place and I entrust them with that. You know, is this person, if it's a jerk and somebody, it's not going to work out, you know, with us. If you're, maybe they're not a jerk, they're awesome at what they do, but wherever they came from, they were the master of disaster. They were the go-to person. Well, now there's two things can happen. You can need that and rely on that. And wherever you go, you got to be the master. And the people we end up hiring, it's very simple and similar and consistent. They say, I just need more people. I like to teach, but I need more people around me I can learn from. That's what I'm hungry to learn. We share that here, and it doesn't matter, not just the consultants, myself, my management team. We need to learn all the time. And if we're not learning, that's enough of a reason to request a change. We need something different. That happens, and happens within our consulting teams and so on, and we care. Again, if you want to be the best place to work, you make your decisions based on where we're going to be happiest. Plus, our customers are happiest when we only take jobs that are great for us, that are a great fit for us. And anything else, we would help them find, you know, somebody else. There's plenty of things we pass on. That's it in a nutshell. I can talk about Chariot for a long time.
So thinking a little bit more about that development piece, a typical client services firm is spending most of their time responding, if not reacting, to customer needs. How do you carve out the bandwidth to be able to stay ahead of those requests? How do your folks actually stay abreast of what's evolving or what that next new technology or that next evolution is going to be that's going to be relevant to your customers, maybe not now, but in 6 months, 1 year, 5 years?
Yep. Great question. And it's a very natural thing. It's one of the easier things to do here because these people do it on their own. You have to understand, I don't tell them to, they're hackers. That's what they are. And so what I have to do is listen to them. And what they have to do is bring it to my attention. And this started, man, over about 10 years ago, one of my people came to me and said, there's this thing called spring. Well, you know, he said, we would like to send 5 people down to Florida for the spring experience. I said, well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Who's paying for that, you know? And he said, no, Spring is a framework. It sits on top of Java. And he said, I think it's the future. You know, there's so many reasons. And he went through all these reasons. I was convinced. Again, it's like test it out. We sent them down to this conference. Well, in the years that followed, Spring dominated. People didn't do Java without Spring. I mean, Spring, now today, Java is not so much the in thing. But Spring dominated Java for a long time. Today, there's a lot of other things. So if you look at, you know, mobile, well, why are we so far ahead with Swift? Swift is the new iOS programming language. Most of our customers and the work we've done for our clients is in Objective-C. It's the, you know, it's existing. But Swift is the future. Our people have evaluated for many, many months, for a long time. They felt, yes, it is going to Swift. And there's reasons why. Swift does things a lot better. It's much more modern in its approach. We're not necessarily convinced that Swift will be used for Android or server-side or some other things that are out there. But the point is that we pay attention to these. Or people are hacking at it. And then they bring it to either our CTO through, we have regular meetings called technical direction. We have a technical direction committee. Here, the technical direction committee has to include every consultant. Not in every meeting, but let me tell you, these people are mad. You really need to. You don't know who will be expert. And even though our breadth, we don't really get involved in like the Microsoft side of the world. Even on our side, there's front-end technologies like Angular and React and Ember and so many other ones. And there's, of course, there's Java and there's Scala and there's the mobile technologies, Objective-C and so on. And there's big data, there's Spark and Hadoop and all these things around that. It's still broader than it may seem. even without touching the Microsoft side of things. And we're involved today in the Internet of Things devices. And I'm learning myself. I'm loving learning about this and how live feeds can come from these devices that are measuring temperature. And I mean, I sat through one of our demos. We put together a demo. There's all these sensors, and one's pressure, and one's heat and light. And you see graphs all on the screen that are digesting this information in real time and sending it back. I can see practical applications for this in many different industries. Although today I'm not doing much work in that space. That's the future. But I'm supporting them in doing that. I'm supporting them in from people. And another thing I didn't mention is, we love to build software. We build great software. It's what we do. It's what we do really, really well because of the people we have. Well, we don't always have to do it for someone else. We could do it for ourselves. I'm not against being in the software business. Now, chariot, knock wood, we've been around a long time and we're very stable and strong. And no, we'll never win awards for being the fastest growing or for being, the wealthiest. But we do great. I mean, we made a profit every year. And some of my mentors may call it very, very thin. But point is, we're very stable and confident enough to constantly revisit our approach. So software came up. One of my people was very passionate about a product. He had an idea, two product ideas. Brought them to the Devil's Advocates crew, and one of them was sort of knocked down, but one of them made it through. And there's a product out there in the market today called Haydle, H-A-Y-D-L-E. It has to do with finding a needle in a haystack, how that name came about. But Joel Confino was the one who worked for me. He became CEO of Haydle. He built the product. He put it out there. We have a small number of customers. Vanguard's by far my largest customer using it. We use it here. It's an amazing product. It's a question and answer system. You want a question? I'll give you an example. I have a team out there. We're doing Scala work. And I have my number one Scala guru on the team. He's not learning very much these days because he's just teaching people. Like, he's just answering questions and he's a little bored, So I'm going to move him. But when I move him, I don't want to move his knowledge. I don't want his knowledge to be, they use Haydle. When any questions about, and he's not the only one. I have a lot of Scala experts that aren't at this particular client. They answer, the questions get answered so fast. And I can't answer the questions, unfortunately, because I'm not qualified, but I look at them all. I follow them. I want to see how effective is this product. It's made me such a big believer in the product and how awesome it is. Are we going to be able to sell it? And is the world going to use Haydle? I have no idea. I'm proud of it, and what it's become. And the fact that we keep this open mind. It takes a lot of guts to be an entrepreneur. You can be very confident in your code and in your software you're developing and dealing with clients. It's another thing to go out there and try to sell and create a business plan. And, it's tough, as I'm sure you know.
Oh, sure. And that, and what our listeners do, most of our listeners are entrepreneurs or folks that are interested in launching their own businesses. It seems like competition for your talent is not necessarily other firms. It's more the individual passions of folks whose development paths might take them into, growing a business of their own. And
yes.
So it seems like you've got a little bit of a path to graduating somebody out of the organization into potentially even becoming a client.
True. Very true. That's extremely true. And it could be that, again, this organization that they start could be a subsidiary or could be part of Chariot or not. But what are they passionate about? And what are they? And that's the kind of people. And if you met these people, you'd understand. You'd want to do the same thing. I am compelled every day, we make our mistakes and nobody's perfect. We're humans. But it's incredible what a team like this, and they're so dedicated. Every once in a while, we don't have a good year. We made a profit every year. But let me tell you, 2010 was tough. And I'll never forget March 11th. And this is, you mentioned about entrepreneurs and your listeners being entrepreneurs. This was a real experience for me. I've been an entrepreneur since I was 6 years old, I believe. Long stories from the old days, but it was new to me. I had a major struggle at the beginning of 2010. I mean, we were hemorrhaging money. And at that time, we didn't have a lot of accumulated, wealth and stability and all of that. Fortunately, I like to listen. One of my consultants is also an expert. These people are experts in a lot of different things. An expert in financial matters and finance and financial planning and contingency planning and all these things. And he came to me and he said, he loses me sometimes with global finance, but he talked to me about Chariot. He said, do you do contingency planning? This is back in 2008. I said, no. He said, really? He said, I'm surprised. You guys are so organized. He said, you should. I said, I know what you mean. His name is Jamie. I said, Jamie, I know what you mean. I said, I believe you're right. I said, I struggle with that. I'm such a positive person. I'm so optimistic to a fault. And it's hard to deal with the man, what if the, hits the fan?
A lot of folks are worried that if they think about that stuff, they're going to attract disaster.
Maybe.
Right?
But I was worried about something. But the point was, I respect him. And when he said, you should do, his response was, you should do it for the group, the team. You should do it for us, for the company. And that's all you have to say to me. And thank goodness we did that. Because I did that with him a couple of years before the stuff hit the fan. And so because he sat down with me, he taught me things I had no idea about. He said, hold on. He said, relax. Take a breath. He said, what's most important to you? I said, what's most important to me is keeping every single person we've worked so hard to get. Because really our struggle, 4 out of 5 years, is just how do we get more people? How do we attract and find more of our kind of people? And when we find them, we don't want to let them go anywhere. And so he said, okay, that's good. And we went down this list. And he says, there's a lot of options that you may not think about right now that you could do when financial, when things go wrong. So fortunately, a couple years later, when things went wrong, at least I had that. But I will tell you, I still was physically sick. I did not feel good. I went in and I called the entire company in on March 11th, 2010 for a meeting. We do company meetings. We do them now bi-monthly. And we talk about everything. We share financial information. We share. Everyone cares, and the good ideas can come from anywhere. So that's how we choose to do it. And in that meeting, I shared everything. I even shared how sick I was to my stomach. You know, I presented to them our challenge. Our challenge was not to make a profit. I didn't think that was realistic. But our challenge was to keep our business going and not lose a single person and be set up for the following year. Now, I will tell you that however many people we had then, maybe 40 people or so, I think all 40 did their part. I'll tell you, they didn't go to so many conferences. They didn't spend their 10% extra, not because we said anything, we didn't change any policy. I didn't force them to go do it that year. And somehow we made a profit. And that somehow is because of 40 people caring, not a couple people, not a management team, not everybody made a difference. And it's the kind of people we have here. I'll never forget it for the rest of my life. And whenever I, the ups and downs, when I encounter a down, I remember that. Don't get sick. You have a great team. You know, that's the key thing. And this is what I'm surrounded by. So main thing is I had to listen all the time. It's the thing I've done best here. And prior to this, I'd tell you different stories. In my prior entrepreneurial ventures, I knew the most. I could develop the software the best. I could sell it the best. I could do all. But you know what? That's limiting. And is that really what my what I'm best at? I don't think so. These days, I think I'm best at something different. I think I'm best at the team, at the coaching, at being, you know, what I'm great at is being keeping my word for things and following through on things I say I'll do, even if it's not good for me personally. You know, that's how we are. We're team players. And so people get that, and you work here for a while, and it's a very addicting place. You're attracted to it, and something, Joe, that I'm most proud of. We won some awards that, you know, since this is being recorded, I don't want to say anything negative about them, but maybe I didn't earn them, but I knew someone or whatever. I don't feel great about those things. I'm not a phony kind of person. I'm not dumb, and I won't, like, say no, I won't accept this award. But the funny thing is, the award for top workplace, for winning number one top workplace. We entered this competition in 2010, and I said to the team, I'm happy to do it. They're going to show the top 25 in the newspaper and online and all that in our category, 50 to 150 employees. I'm confident we'll be in the top 25. And I'm even more confident we won't be number one. They said, why? I said, because I'm from Philadelphia. I've lived my whole life in Philadelphia. And you don't get number one unless you know somebody with something like this. And we know nobody. Well, we finished number one. Shocked me. I was shocked. And then we didn't enter for another 4 years. We entered in 2014. We finished number one again. And I was shocked. And eventually I got to meet the company that runs that top workplaces is a company called Workplace Dynamic. And I was speaking on a panel about company culture. And the moderator introduced himself, and he said he was from Workplace Dynamics. And I said, I have to talk to you after this session. I really have some questions for you. And I spoke to him. You know what? I love those people. He said, we have our own secret sauce. He said, you know, if you see, and everybody has perfect scores, and the comments don't support it, and you know, because companies will tell their people, it's in your best interest to rate us highly, you know, because we'll get more people. Well, he says, they're gone. They're thrown out. They're not even considered. He says, I'll tell you another thing. We had a problem with Chariot. Yours was almost too good in 2014. You almost got thrown out because this particular gentleman knows some of our people. And so Workplace Dynamics asked him to recuse himself from the judging. He told me all this stuff. I love that organization. Just how they do those little things that I just heard means they take what they do very seriously.
Well, I think that comes back to your definition of brand, that it carried so far out that an organization like that that would normally be scanning for what they would define as fraud, they see your applications come in and go, oh, those guys, yeah, they're like that.
Right, right.
Totally on brand for them.
No, absolutely. And that to me, that's an incredibly spoiled and incredibly proud of that award that actually really didn't come from others. It mostly came from our people. I mean, they digest the input from at least 50 people have to respond from your company. And so I don't know who said what. All I know is it's confirmation that I'm doing pretty well with my top priority, you know, which is their happiness.
And so, well, we're almost out of time, but I do want to touch on the idea that when you're recruiting, and you said earlier that it's not necessarily just about money, because we're both in Philadelphia, we talk a lot with folks who are thinking about locating businesses in Philadelphia versus Silicon Valley. I spent 6 years working in business development for Apple, so I spent a lot of time out in the Valley.
Yep.
And you can have a quality of life, I think, in Philadelphia that's significantly better for half the salary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because how many people do I know that are, you know, six to a bedroom in San Jose,
yep,
compared to folks I know who are living in the corridor either between Philadelphia and Lancaster? You know, yep. I know one developer that just bought a farmhouse because they've always wanted to live in a farmhouse. Just did it because they could do it and still have a good quality of life and work from home, commute. You know, the things that you find your people tell you that they're looking for, what are they saying that they're coming to Chariot to get? What are the things that attract them to a place where, as opposed to just going to another organization?
The main thing, and there are several things, and they're not consistent, but the one consistent thing I would say more than anything else is they have a need to see the fruits of their labor. A little different. A lot of places you're not going to see that. But they actually need to move the needle. Like in this case, they have to move the needle for our client. Well, there's a reason I don't, my specialty is not large companies like Comcast and Vanguard. Yes, they're my big, Comcast is my biggest customer. We succeed there. But mostly, it's hard to move the needle. And how do you see what you've done? So I'll tell you, like at Vanguard as an example, I'm not sure which company's names I'm allowed to use officially for something like this. That's the thing. These people have been my customers forever. So I'm not exactly sure what I could say, but at a big company there, we had two or three people. And a friend of mine runs that project or that customer for a different consulting company in the area, much larger than we are. They had 200 to 300 people. We didn't want any of those roles. We didn't feel that was the roles we can move the needle. Where we were is the next generation software architecture. It's still hard to see the ultimate results, but at least you could see the teams and what they're building with the technologies you're sending down. And you could see this company who's been in the dark ages and some of these technologies really modernize, and you can feel great about it. Okay, Comcast even better. Companies like that where you can help with big data. You move the needle and you change response rate by 0.1% for Comcast, you're talking about millions and millions of dollars. And they see the difference. Our people see that a few years ago, they couldn't even track some of this on-demand behavior and data because of the technologies we're limiting to them, based on databases as opposed to things like Hadoop, these other data. It's awesome. So we do thrive there because of the teams we're on and the impact we can see. But people will not be happy here if they're just getting paid to write code and do their job. And that, you know, just do your thing and have your limited role. They all have other passions. They all have other desires. And what we have to specialize here is understanding who's into what. You know, like who is an expert in their software development, but they're big on cloud and they totally are passionate about the cloud and its impact. I have people like that. You know, people who wants to be, who isn't an expert today in mobile, but they're passionate about it. That's where they want to be. You know, we have all of this. It goes on all the time here. Is our director of consulting, Don Coleman, has an entire matrix for everybody here so that we don't lose track. We don't want to ignore what they want. They're patient. We'll get them where they want if we can make, you know, if we can build a business there. But we have to listen to them all the time. They have to know we're listening. Personality has a lot to do with these things. You can tell in their personality, how professional are they? How much of a team player are they? Are they humble or are they overconfident? This team of interviewers does such an incredible job. After the interview, they get sent to Aaron Mulder, who's my CTO. Aaron's a tough animal. He's just a brilliant, brilliant, smartest person I ever met. Too smart for me to really evaluate. But they come into him and he almost never rejects anyone. And Aaron was the master of this plan, not by himself, but with the team. But he really was the author of this approach that we've taken from the beginning. And the stats of his rejects are very rare. And when he does, sometimes he looks at something and says, well, they've been doing this for 20 years or 15 years. And his is a little different of an assessment. He looks to see where they are and there may be a lack of passion. Here's the deal. When I accept this. I'm a numbers person also. Like I like statistics and other things. And I get technical sometimes. When we agreed at the beginning to only hire the top tier people and take no risks with that, you have to understand scientifically that means you will reject some people that would have been superstars. Mm. Because right whenever you're in doubt, and we run into them at our clients. I hear it. Oh, we should have hired this guy. He's killing it. You know, I know that and I accept that. That's our approach. Then you have to accept that. And so we do accept that. And so occasionally Aaron sees something or has another angle And when in doubt, we reject. Now, if someone has worked with someone before and can vouch for them and how they are, and it speaks to Aaron's concern, that's different. You know? So we're looking for people. We're not as dead set on what the resume says and exactly how many years and all these things. It's not that. It's their aptitude, their passion, really, for this space and what we do. We would take a young junior person or, you know, less experienced person if that's the kind of person, they're the kind of person that belongs here.
But I think that speaks to the way that you've chosen to evolve the company very organically, as opposed to startups. I think we've both seen where suddenly they get a VC check and the next thing is go hire 20 devs. And yes. The goal is fill a room with devs, not fill a room with the right devs.
Yes.
And an organization like yours that may already have cultivated this expert culture and this teaching culture where maybe you only need 4 people on a team for a client as opposed to 20 people who are banging on typewriters.
Yes, absolutely. Well, fortunately, we have the support. Everyone is aligned, including our board. So I have a board. It's a board of advisors, but we listen. So it's like a board that has more power. They support this. Back from when we initially came up with this set of goals and objectives, it was different than what they did. It really was. It took a little bit of an adjustment period, but they've supported us all the way through. As a matter of fact, Joe, when we first started the company, I did raise a little bit of money. It was like a friends and family. It's the best you could do back then. Like an angel round, I'll call it, of people that actually were partly my mentors. The David Lipson, there's a gentleman named Buck Bell who also passed away, but Buck was one of the co-founders of Safeguard in the 50s. He was much older, but Dave Elric and many others that are still on my board that I did raise some money from them. And I did have a plan when we first started the business that said we'll have a liquidity event at some point. Because that's what I thought you'd do when you start a business, you know. And so, but I learned from this group. And about, because 2010, we had a clause in there that said as of January 1st, 2010, any investor can, because it's not a liquid type of investment right now, but any investor can cash out at an annual rate of return of 10%, which is great. From 2002, that's a pretty high number.
Solid years, yeah.
Right. So, but no one did. None of them did. But it was important that they had that opportunity. They embraced. And the reason I brought that up then was I don't want to sell the company. I changed my mind. I had a different opinion. That doesn't mean I wouldn't sell Hadle or we wouldn't sell a subsidiary. Those are investments and kind of seen as that. This company is a service business. It's only worth so much when you're a service business anyway. It's not like that. And it's too beautiful and great and special for me to let somebody ruin it, you know, and someone acquires you and then they got to be, everyone has to be big. Everyone cares too much about money, quite frankly. I mean, we need to make a profit. Don't get me wrong. Because you don't make a profit, you may not have this special. But that's as far as we're really willing to go with how much we want to put the importance on profit, you know, how profitable you need to be. If you're out to maximize, as I was trained as a CEO, my job is to maximize shareholder wealth. I admit to you, I'm not executing on that in this job.
But by design.
By design. And my shareholders know it.
You're putting constraints on yourself. And so to wrap up our conversation, you're entering the 15th year of operating this business. Tell me what your dream is for year 25. You know, when we talk about your 25th anniversary, what are some of the accomplishments? What are some of the things you want to see the team have executed on when we talk about 25 years of Chariot Solutions?
We add another 10 years. My main aspirations or hopes for us are I do want to spread out. I want our impact to affect a lot more than just the Philadelphia area. Today, 80%+ of my business is literally in the Philadelphia area. We have a lot of love we can give outside of here to many, many other people. And my purpose or intent is to, again, support the individual business units. Like I expect 10 years from now, I want to be one of the leading mobile development firms in the country. That is specific and specific about mobile. I wouldn't tell you that about Scala, and I wouldn't tell you that about any one language or one technology. It involves server side and so on, but it's a different animal and it fits right into our sweet spot. And today I'm not really known for mobile. I don't think Chariot's known as much for mobile as many of these other, you know, Java, of course, enterprise development. Yes, of course. But I roll with the punches. The main thing is I would want to be bigger. Not a lot bigger. You know, today we're 60 people. I can go as big as 100, I think, and still be happy. Now, that may sound like not aggressive goals, but for me it is. I need to be happy. I have a very close relationship with everybody. That's hard. It's already hard for me to do. A lot harder than it was when we were 25. So it's crucial to me to maintain that here and be even more special. When you know, again, if I can affect more than just the Philadelphia area, I could have much more to offer my people. People want to be practice leads. People want to lead. You know, the New York thing is a great example. I did an entrepreneur, you know. It can start as like I was. I was a developer, you know, but I knew I was an entrepreneur. I had things I needed to do. I had a disease from the beginning. My brothers didn't have this. I had it. I had to do it. And some of them have that, and they want it. And I want them. I want to support that, even if it means ultimately, like you said, it's fine. It's maybe a logical way to branch out and go somewhere else. So what?
But I need to imagine the concept that you could have clones of your unit now, but spread out to New York, DC, Boston, you know, that operate the way that you do now, but addressing those geographic needs.
That's exactly what I want. And the reason I say that is I know in some of my board that, you know, they always bring up the argument and the discussion because we are successful doing remote work today. It's not the same. It's not the same as being able to be on site. Even if a customer says you can be on site as needed, it's up to you. In many cases, we're on site every day for certain periods of time because I ask them, you know, why are you there? Well, we need to be there. Great. Okay. Well, it's harder to do that in Madison, Wisconsin, or in certain parts of California, or even now Boston's pretty easy. DC area, pretty easy for us. New York, pretty easy. We did Weight Watchers, some other business in New York. It really was not too bad.
Because we got a good train for that.
Right, but exactly.
You get outside of that. And
still a lot easier, though, to be there. If you have a place that's closer, so much, we spend so much time on site. And then sometimes we bring other people out. There's a problem. Our customer is our customer. Whatever they need help with, we will help them. They can ask us. And sometimes we need to bring Aaron in or Don or some of our masterminds in other areas for a brainstorm, whatever it may be. We're open to it. I mean, at Comcast, I mean, we're not experts in the cable industry. You know, we use cable TV. But once we gave them certain other capabilities to store this data, then is the fun part. What decisions do you make that will increase revenue, that will, you know, change your business? So we even had a brainstorm here. So we're users. We came up with ideas and sent over to them. I know they at least appreciate that we did it. You know, it doesn't cost them anything, but we want them to be successful.
But I think that shows the added value that you provide when it's contract renewal time. Are they folks that add value and come up with great ideas, or the folks that just show up to type in the keywords?
What you're assessing or implying is exactly what happens. That's what's great about our business, and that's what they do. The people we work for, they fight for us. That's who they want, and there's obvious reasons why they want that, and this has a lot to do with it.
Great. Michael Rappaport, founder, CEO, Chariot Solutions, thanks for joining us on The Build.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
The Build is a production of 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Our producer is Lori Taylor. Our associate producer is Katie Cohen-Zonizer. Our talent coordinators are Katrina Smith and Gazem Yali, and our post-production team is led by Evan Wilder at Flowly Audio in Detroit. My name is Joe Taylor, Jr. Thanks for listening to The Build.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 radio production.